slippers on shoes.
What's the matter, Morty?
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
Fashion has changed.
No, it hasn't.
Hi, I'm Lauren Garoni.
And I'm Chelsea Fairless.
And welcome back to the Every Outfit Podcast.
Shall we get straight into it?
Oh, did something big happen?
Something big did happen this past Friday. The Costume Institute announced the theme of their big spring exhibition, and it's all about John Galliano. Before we get into the backlash, shall we get into the press release that the Costume Institute released?
Of course, but before we even get into the press release, can we discuss the timing of the press release, which it was dropped Friday afternoon, which in PR terms usually means people only do this when they want to bury a news story. However, in an internet world, I don't think things work like that anymore.
Totally. But they clearly wanted to minimize the backlash. Like, even with this podcast, we typically record on Thursdays because there is typically a lack of news on Fridays.
For sure. Although, upon retrospect, all the news we do want to cover is the news that typically people want to bury.
Friday news. Okay, anyway, the show is called John Galliano Horizons. According to the press release, it will draw extensively from the Costume Institute's holdings of Galliano's work, the largest collection of its kind in the world, including examples from his landmark 1984 graduation collection at Central St. Martin's in London, and culminating with his critically acclaimed Margiela Spring Summer 2004 collection.
Which I don't think many people have read the press release. I think they just saw John Galliano subject to this year or next year's Met Gala and lost their minds and were like, what about the controversies? Which they get into in the following paragraph of this press release.
Yes, they addressed this straight away. The press release says, alongside Galliano's extraordinary creative accomplishments, the exhibition will address the derogatory conduct that fundamentally altered his career and public reception. In doing so, the exhibition will consider how artistic achievement should be understood alongside ethical accountability.
So there you go. Problem solved. All right. Can't wait for May, guys.
Okay, I don't want to get into the intricacies of his cancellation again, but for those of you who have completely forgotten, in 2011, he got blackout drunk at La Pearl in Paris, and he got in a fight with a couple other people at the restaurant, and he made horrible, racist, anti-Semitic comments towards these people.
Which he maintains to this day that he has no memory of this incident. He was swiftly fired from his position at Dior, and then later that year in 2011, he was charged in a Paris courtroom for hate crimes. Which, when this court case happened, they brought up a second incident that actually happened prior to the publicized incident that happened in 2010 that he also has no memory of.
At the same cafe.
Yes.
Yeah, because I guess in France you can get charged with a hate crime for speech, which I do not believe is the case here.
We do have hate speech, but yes, in particular, they are very sensitive, understandably so, to anti-Semitism. I did find it interesting in the press release, they go on to say how the exhibition is going to be broken up. And it's going to be organized into three movements, Bearings, Horizons, and Atlas of Transformation. The first, Bearings, will open with a conceptual chronology connecting Galliano's career and collections to broader historical and cultural events. It will directly address the rupture caused by his anti-Semitic, racist, and anti-Asian conduct in 2010 and 2011, which resulted in a dismissal from Christian Dior and his eponymous label, and his conviction by a Paris court for public insults based on race, religion, ethnicity, or origin. To me, with this press release, it shows that they have really thought about how to present this and how this was going to be received.
Totally. But also, how are they actually going to present this? Are they going to show the video? Are they going to put, like, I love Hitler on the wall?
Which is something he said. I do appreciate, because it is often lost in this conversation, that not only did he make anti-Semitic remarks, but in the incident he didn't remember, he made anti-Asian remarks.
Yeah, the anti-Semitism has really overshadowed the anti-Asian aspect of his tirade.
So, as we hinted at before, clearly Anna Wintour, Andrew Bolton, the people behind the Costume Institute, knew that this was going to get a reaction, which is probably why they dropped this news on Friday afternoon. But again, as I said, the way the internet works, it did not die down. And I saw, I have to say, some of the worst takes I've seen on the internet in a minute.
Yeah.
And I don't mind a bad take, but I do mind a bad take that's not rooted in any kind of reality. Like I told you, I saw a tweet that was like, really, really? We're doing Galliano before Margiela? It's like, yeah.
But also, we should do both. Look, I think that everyone is totally entitled to their feelings about Galliano. I have no desire to try to convince someone who hates him to like him. However, when people start to make the argument that his work shouldn't be shown in museums, then I take issue. If you don't like him, don't go to the show.
Yes. And I would say that the backlash kind of falls into a couple of different lanes. There are younger people I've noticed who were maybe alive when John Galliano was fired from Dior, but are learning for the first time how and why he was fired. And then you have people who just do not want this exhibition to happen. And then you have the other group of people who are like, yeah, I mean, obviously his work warrants an exhibition, but why can't it happen when he's dead?
Totally.
And for those who don't know, this show at the Costume Institute is unprecedented for a few reasons. Galliano is only the third living designer to even have a retrospective. The first was Yves Saint Laurent in 1983. That was under Diana Vreeland's tenure. And then the Costume Institute did a show about Rei Kawakubo in 2017.
I do want to point out that Miuccia Prada also did get a show, but it was a joint show with Elsa Schiaparelli. Not totally the same thing, but another modern designer that has gotten the big retrospective while she's still alive.
And we've discussed this before. We know that Andrew Bolton in 2024 tried to push through a Galliano retrospective then and did not have support from the board. So it's not exactly surprising that we are finally getting a Galliano retrospective.
Yes, they've been trying to push this through for a while. It is clearly something that is very, like, personally important to Anna Wintour and to Andrew Bolton. Anna Wintour specifically has been investing in him, championing him, supporting him for a really, really long time. And that extends well before his cancellation and the image rehabilitation that she helped to coordinate.
Yeah, it's worth noting that when she has been interviewed and asked about her favorite fashion collection ever, she has listed multiple times John Galliano's Fall-Winter 1994 collection. She was instrumental in him getting his job first at Givenchy and then at Dior. So her tenure at Vogue is very intimately intertwined with John Galliano's career as well.
Totally. And they get into this in the documentary High and Low, which we talked about last year, year before. But there was a point in the early 90s where Galliano, his business was like completely bankrupt. He'd lost all of his investors. He barely had the money to like eat or buy fabric for his shows. And Anna and Andre Leontali specifically made it their mission to help his brand survive during that period. It was more like a sort of patron of the arts role than a typical designer-editor relationship. They helped them find venues, find models, find stylists, find backers. And I don't know if he would have gotten that Givenchy job if not for what they did for him.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's telling that in this retrospective, they are starting with his graduation collection at Central St. Martin's. I mean, to say that he's a preternatural talent is underselling it, honestly.
Totally. And we also got that in the McQueen show, which is kind of the closest type of exhibition that they've done to this Galliano show, I'm imagining, in the sort of theatricality, the sort of controversial nature of the designer, and the darkness, I suppose, around these people.
So I don't exactly know about the timing, if Vanessa Friedman's article came out first or the press release, but certainly on the same day, Vanessa Friedman broke the news in the style section of the New York Times. While she didn't outright say that she did not like this show, we could read between the lines.
Yeah, I know that The New York Times is supposed to be impartial, but I felt that she couldn't conceal her bias in this article, which was almost entirely about his cancellation and not really about his work at all.
She basically was like, yeah, he had a 14-year tenure at Dior, and that's it.
Yeah.
I'm excited to have GU as a sponsor of today's podcast. I've seen GU all over my feed. Their best-selling rejuvenation toner pads have become a viral sensation. But I've tried a viral skincare product here and there in the past, and I've been burned before. Not literally, metaphorically. That's why I was skeptical when I first heard about GU. Korean skincare has become famous for delivering incredible results, but it can be expensive, overwhelming, and packed with complicated routines. That's what I love about GU. They change all of that. They've taken the most effective innovations in Korean skincare and combined them into simple, affordable products that are easy to use and actually fit into your daily routine. Those best-selling rejuvenation toner pads have made it easy to get the kind of healthier, brighter, smoother-looking skin that normally takes an entire shelf of products to achieve. Think of them as an entire Korean skincare routine packed into a single swipe. In just a few seconds a day, you're helping target dark spots, uneven texture, discoloration, fine lines, wrinkles, and other visible signs of aging. And for this aging millennial, that's what I need. Every pad is saturated with 8 clinically backed Korean skincare activities like niacinamide, which brightens and evens tone, peptides, which supports elasticity and firmness, and snail mucin, which hydrates and soothes. You could use these toning pads just on your face, but I've seen videos of women putting the toner pads on their elbows, knees, and even below the belt to help their skin looking smoother, brighter, and more even. For a limited time, GU is having a crazy deal for our listeners. Not only is their Glow Up bundle up to 45% off right now, but our listeners can now get an additional 20% off plus free shipping with our code OUTFIT at JIYUSkin.com. That's JIYUSkin.com and use code OUTFIT for an additional 20% off. After you purchase, they will ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that Every Outfit sent you.
We did learn some really interesting things from this article, though. One is that the Met and Anna Wintour staged a meeting between Galliano and a bunch of Jewish community leaders and rabbis ahead of this announcement.
Which, when I was reading that line, I'm like, isn't that the beginning of a Borscht Belt joke? Like, Anna Wintour, Andrew Bolton, John Galliano, and a handful of influential rabbis and Jewish leaders walk into the Met Museum.
Well, from my understanding, this is just kind of how John Galliano spends his free time. Because also in that documentary, we learned that I believe the Anti-Defamation League, like, paired him with a rabbi immediately after he got out of rehab for his drug addiction.
Yes, I want to get into this because Anna Wintour is often pointed to as the architect of his rehabilitation, which is true, but there is also someone a little more behind the scenes, which is Jonathan Newhouse, who is the chairman of Condé Nast. He is actually the one who introduced him to Abraham Foxman, who was at the time the head of the Anti-Defamation League, who did pair him up with various rabbis, scheduled a tour for him at Auschwitz, really kind of took him through the paces. Also, Jonathan Newhouse is featured in the High and Low documentary, and that documentary about Galliano is a co-production with Condé Nast Entertainment.
Yes, and also Anna Wintour was apparently instrumental in sort of getting this documentary made.
Yes, it was shopped around to many directors for a long time before they found the person who ended up directing the documentary.
Yeah, and I believe we learned that he also had to, like, read a lot about anti-Semitism, educate himself. He ended up speaking at a lot of Jewish community events. He volunteered to teach at a fashion school in Israel, which declined him.
Understandably so. To be fair, that was only a few years after the incident, but it did spark a memory in us, which is Galliano around the same time was going to teach a 4-day seminar at Parsons. This is after the time we graduated and there was protests, and so he no longer was going to teach the seminar at Parsons, which just makes me think between that anecdote and this new information that he offered his services to a fashion school in Israel just makes me think that he was going from school to school being like, I'll teach.
What if he ends up teaching at an Israeli fashion school and then just gets canceled by a completely different group of people?
It's very possible. I guess my confusion about this is, and I can't directly point to the kind of do better crowd is the same people that don't want this exhibition to happen. But it's not like this incident happened a year ago and now he's getting a retrospective. He has done the work. You can think that it wasn't enough to warrant this exhibition, but I mean, I think he's certainly paid for what he's done. The Anti-Defamation League has come out a few years ago and after this exhibition was announced and have said that they believe that this exhibition should happen, but certainly understand people are upset about this idea.
See, I think while people should be held accountable for their actions, especially racism and anti-Semitism, I also think that there is a segment of the population that really does feel that he deserves to be punished, feels that he hasn't been punished enough. I think that sort of person probably would be comfortable with him getting these accolades when he's dead, but not when he's alive. From my perspective, I think he lost a lot. He lost his employment for years. People don't think he lost it for long enough, though.
For sure. He also still doesn't have the rights back to his eponymous label that is still owned by LVMH.
And his reputation is permanently damaged forever.
Yeah, I'm sure Galliano would rather have a retrospective that didn't have to focus on the worst moments of his life, but here we are. And I think Andrew Bolton spoke to this in the Vanessa Friedman piece. Avoiding his work doesn't remove his influence on fashion or solve the ethical questions around it, Bolton continued. Our responsibility is neither to celebrate uncritically nor avoid that difficult history, but establish the record honestly, provide context, and create the conditions for visitors to make an informed judgment.
I appreciate what he said. I'm an adult. I can choose whether or not I want to go and see this or not. I can draw my own conclusions from his body of work as well as his personal narrative.
Yeah, although I did take issue with this quote from Anna where she says, I feel quite strongly that our culture has begun to move too quickly towards condemnation, toward a feeling of certainty that particular offenses or mistakes are unforgivable. The truth is we rarely know the full story and all of us are fallible.
What's wrong with that?
The issue I take with that is that the truth is we rarely know the full story. Actually, we kind of do know the full story with John Galliano because he has been on this 13-year rehabilitation tour, the peak of which I think is the documentary. He has explained himself for anyone who has watched the documentary. And for those who haven't, he explains that it was a confluence of events that he was addicted to sleeping pills, Valium, as well as alcohol, that his father had just died along with two other people in his life. There were mounting pressures at Dior. I'm not justifying this, but he did come up in an era where the work just got more and more and more. I mean, he was designing 24 collections a year.
We're still in that era. What do you think Jonathan Anderson is doing right now?
But I do think there are more guardrails for designers of this era who saw what it did to other designers.
I don't know about that. I think it's also worth mentioning that at the time of the incident, he was also like extremely sleep deprived, like chronically sleep deprived and hearing voices. I think one of the most memorable aspects of the High and Low documentary was the part that was about, I think he was at the Ritz.
Oh, yes.
He was at the Ritz. He had like a mental breakdown slash bender where he got in the elevator naked and was in there for 4 hours. And whenever the elevator doors opened, he would pretend to be a lion and growl at the guests that were trying to get on the elevator.
Yes. And the president of Christian Dior at the time had to go get him out of the elevator and I think pay for either that guest who saw him naked in the elevator or perhaps a whole floor of guests as an apology. Again, not justifying any of this behavior.
No, and drunk words or sober thoughts.
Just giving context and also explaining that I think it's funny that Anna Wintour is like, no one knows the full story. It's like, lady, you push forth a documentary so we did know the full story.
I think she meant that more broadly, though, and it's true. We all sit here judging people based on the little fragments of information that we have about them. And a lot of us aren't perfect. And have maybe done some fucked up, regrettable things in our lives. I'm not talking about me. I am perfect.
Oh, moi.
I'm perfect. Just kidding.
I think it really comes down to a conversation about is it worth having this exhibition when John Galliano is living versus doing this posthumously, like with Karl Lagerfeld? Because this conversation did come up for the Lagerfeld Met exhibition, where a lot of his bad behavior, not to this degree, but a lot of his fatphobic comments came back into light in the press.
They're both fucking assholes. Clearly.
Yeah, I don't know how many creative geniuses who are great people. I wish both could exist together, but it kind of bears out in the creative world that those two things kind of can't coexist.
But I don't even think this is limited to fashion designers. I think generally speaking, artists are very complicated, fucked up people. But I also don't want the Met to then take down a Caravaggio painting or something because he's a literal murderer. I don't want the public to decide what I can and can't see based on the life of the artist.
That's interesting because I think this conversation that's been happening increasingly every year with the Met Gala is this idea that the chronically online public wants a say in what the Costume Institute exhibition is going to be. And that's just not how things work. And that's sort of my feeling about this, which is there are powers that be far beyond our reach who have wanted this to happen going back a decade.
And maybe they thought they had earned some goodwill with their more recent exhibitions, right? Because last year's show, the Superfine exhibition, was all about Black dandies. During the pandemic, they did those two shows that were more broadly about American fashion, but certainly emphasized POC designers more than the Costume Institute would have done if that show was in the 90s, for example.
Yes, an ungenerous read of this is that Andrew Bolton was like, look, I did three woke exhibits. Like, let me do my one problematic designer one.
Exactly. I'm sure they thought about it in that way.
Dearest listener, one morning recently I was sitting having a peaceful cup of coffee. My son crawled around on the rug. It was a perfect morning, really, until in a split second I took my eye off said coffee and my son stood up and knocked the coffee off the table, making it spill all over our rug. That's when I knew it was time to get a tumble rug. If you have kids or pets, you know rugs basically become ground zero for every spill, stain, and disaster. I had resisted the idea of a washable rug for a long time because I thought I would be sacrificing style for function. But this was my breaking point, and luckily Tumble has very chic rugs. Tumble rugs feature a proprietary spill-proof surface that causes liquids to bead up on top of the rug, so instead of soaking into the fibers like most rugs, you can literally wipe away spills in seconds. And when you need a deeper clean, Tumble rugs are fully machine washable, even the larger sizes. You just remove the rug from the pad, toss it into the washer. If you have pets, these rugs will absolutely change your life. I'm a particular fan of their Pharma collection. It's a minimalist carpet that comes in ivory, brick, and olive, inspired by the artist Saul LeWitt. They also have a collection of intricately designed rugs inspired by the work of Frida Kahlo. How many washable rug companies can say that? I think no one else but Tumble. But don't believe me. Believe the hundreds of thousands of homes who have already switched to Tumble rugs, and they have over 30,000 five-star reviews. Machine washable rugs made better. For a limited time only, our listeners get 10% off plus free shipping at tumbleliving.com/outfit. That's tumble living.com/outfit. After you purchase, they will ask you where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them that Every Outfit sent you. I think it's a confluence of events, okay? I think it is doing more, for lack of a better phrase, woke exhibits in recent years. I feel like they earned doing this. And also, this has not been confirmed just yet, but if I was putting money on Kalshi or Polymarket, maybe I'll start this bet. I'm going to guess that Zara, who is the current employer of John Galliano, is going to underwrite this exhibition.
Very possible. I don't see a downside to them doing that.
They have their corporate backer. They have goodwill, or at least I guess they thought goodwill from the last few exhibitions.
I can also see a world where they find a Jewish and an Asian co-chair.
Oh.
For the optics of it.
Now that's interesting. You're right. The co-chairs and the corporate sponsor has not been announced yet.
Yeah. A possibility. We'll see.
So a lot of our fashion mothers, our fashion cool aunts had thoughts about this, mostly in their Substacks. Can we discuss Dana Thomas's Substack?
Oh, yeah. Love Dana Thomas. Her Substack is an essential read, and she has been reporting on this rumored Galliano show for a long time. She actually broke this story months ago.
Right. And she wrote the book Gods and Kings, which is about the rise and fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano. So she has some feelings about this. My favorite part of her Substack is a little bit bitchy, but quite funny, where she's talking about how there's a part in the press release that talks about how it's going to feature a lot of John Galliano's ephemera from his early days. And she goes, that's so interesting because I wrote in my book that his initial backers from the 80s and early 90s lost all of his ephemera. You know who actually has a lot of Galliano press clippings? Me. And it's so weird. Andrew Bolton hasn't contacted me yet. Interesting.
Yeah, I thought that was funny. I'd love to see her personal archives. But then I was really interested to see right before we sat down to record, a New York Times op-ed came out that she wrote about how this show should not happen.
And she too has taken the stance that his work warrants a show just not when he's alive. So it's like, so you do think that the show should happen?
Well, it's interesting coming from someone who spent 5 years writing a book about Galliano, who clearly thinks that his work is important, that he's someone that should be studied, that he's a sort of seminal figure in modern fashion history.
And we should also note, this book came out after Galliano's cancellation. The book was released in 2015. So she does feel that his life warranted her spending years researching it to put in a book, but not enough to have an exhibition.
I think it's really interesting because I wouldn't expect that that would be her perspective. You can think he's a horrible asshole, piece of shit.
Well, when you take her op-ed that came out today and then you pair it next to her Substack, which came out a few days ago, it's like, do you not want this exhibition to happen because Andrew Bolton hasn't called you yet? Inquiring minds would like to know.
I would like to know. But respect to Dana and all of the work that she has done on this particular subject, we will be reading Gods and Monsters for an upcoming book club episode.
It feels a little weird to want to fan cast the red carpet, but I can't help it. I must.
Who's going to be brave enough to wear the homeless collection?
Here's the thing, though. What has become so difficult when we fan cast the Met Gala red carpet is we always point out the obvious good references, and then no one does them, I think, because they are the obvious ones.
That's true. I think we will see certainly a lot of vintage. I think a lot of people will want to wear vintage. I think we'll see people do full looks in a way that maybe we haven't seen before, where it's not just the outfit, it's also the hair and the glam, because the runway images are so over the top and so perfect for the Met Gala that I can see people just going all in and being like, fuck it.
Yeah, one thing we didn't touch upon in why having a Galliano retrospective in 2027 made sense is, if you remember in 2024, or was it 2025, whatever year they wanted to do, or Andrew Bolton tried to do a Galliano exhibition, a lot of people showed up in Galliano, whether it was Kim Kardashian in Margiela or Zendaya in a vintage Galliano. I think it was for Dior, or was it Givenchy?
She did two looks, remember?
I do remember, and that scared us. And thankfully, no one else has done two looks on the red carpet at the Met yet. But I don't know if the red carpet is going to be anticlimactic because we've had so many Galliano moments in recent years.
Yeah, but not extreme ones. Not on the level of the Met Gala.
That is true. I agree with you. I do hope that people reference Pat McGrath's amazing work with Galliano. When I think about the beauty looks, I specifically think about the spring-summer 2003 collection with that almost kabuki makeup.
Yeah, totally.
Now, this is not going to happen, but it would be cool if it did. And perhaps the gowns I'm about to reference are going to be in the exhibition. But if Kate Moss and Gwen Stefani showed up in their wedding dresses.
Yeah, I think that would be a great move for Gwen Stefani. Kate Moss, I hope she does something different. But that Gwen Stefani wedding dress still just lives rent-free in my mind. we need to see her in it again.
If I had to guess, because I do believe, I think it was the V&A did a wedding exhibition. I think her gown was in it. It has made the exhibition rounds. I don't know if Gwen Stefani, currently married to Blake Shelton, wants to wear her wedding dress when she was married to Gavin Rossdale.
Okay, well, if we can't get that, I think the better version would be Celine Dion wearing the backwards pantsuit again, if we're doing repeats.
Speaking of repeats, what if we got Sarah Jessica Parker's return to the Met Gala red carpet in the newsprint dress?
I don't think she's doing that.
I don't think so either. But that's why we fan cast the red carpet.
But I think that she will be back. I think that this designer will get her back.
I don't know. I could see her sitting this one out. I think there will be a lot of bias cut dresses, which is a dress style that he is known for.
For sure. But I feel like people have to go more extreme than that. Like, I'm sure like Lauren Santo Domingo will show up in like the perfect like vintage bias cut dress that isn't some crazy theatrical thing. But I think most people will really want that wow factor, which you actually can get from this man.
Yes. Summer is full of vacations, weekend getaways, and spending more time outdoors. And when you're packing for a trip, the last thing you want is to be worrying about your hair. That's one of the reasons I've loved having Nutrafol as part of my routine. It's helped me feel more confident about my hair whether I'm heading to the beach, exploring a new city, or just enjoying a long weekend away. For the last year or so, I was taking their postpartum formula, but now I'm back to their women's formula to help with shedding. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist recommended hair growth supplement brand, and it's the number one hair growth supplement brand personally used by dermatologists. And that's the thing, isn't it? Everyone's root causes of hair thinning are different, so a one-size-fits-all approach to hair growth doesn't cut it. That's why Nutrafol has multiple formulas that are tailored to give your hair what it needs to grow throughout different stages, such as postpartum and menopause, as well as for different lifestyles, such as plant-based diets. Nutrafol's hair growth supplements are peer-reviewed, NSF-certified for sport, and clinically tested. Let your hair be one less thing to worry about. See visibly thicker, stronger, faster-growing hair in 3 to 6 months with Nutrafol. For a limited time, Nutrafol is offering our listeners $10 off your first month subscription and free shipping when you visit Nutrafol.com and enter promo code OUTFIT. That's Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code OUTFIT. It'll be interesting to see who the other big brands are that buy tables at the Galliano retrospective. Because last year it was very big on Saint Laurent. I don't know if he will buy in. Will Galliano's former employer, LVMH, will Dior have a big table or will they sit this one out?
I think they will definitely be attending, for sure.
Because Galliano was at Jonathan Anderson's first couture show.
Yeah. And they also showed video clips from his old collections ahead of, I think, was it the first couture show or was it just his first women's ready-to-wear show? I forget. But they're not shying away from the fact that Galliano was at the helm of this brand for so many years and really helped to define the way we think about Dior in the modern era, post-Christian Dior, obviously.
Sorry, Yves Saint Laurent.
I really hope that someone goes full Princess Lucretia, like hair, glam, hoop skirt, potentially like running up the steps could be amazing. I feel like Elle Fanning might be able to rise to this challenge. We shall see. I also hope that Addison Rae wears something incredibly stupid from one of those like Y2K Dior collections that just like wasn't that formal, you know, like that one show that was all like striped thigh highs and like little micro shorts.
You know what designer I definitely think will be attending and who could attend with Addison Rae would be Marc Jacobs.
Oh, for sure.
Because Marc Jacobs, a contemporary of John Galliano, but someone who loves wearing other designers.
Totally. And I'm so excited to see all of these designers rip off Galliano with impunity. It's going to be great.
I'm looking for this quote that was also in the New York Times article that Anna Wintour said, which I think is so true about Galliano, right? Designers dream of changing the world with a single collection. John has done it over and over again. And I think our ability to call out these iconic moments from his collections that have happened decade after decade point to that.
Totally. And also, he just did it again. Like, that Margiela Couture show is still the best fashion show that all of us have seen for a really long time. Will someone finally wear the Merkin? I don't know.
I mean, here's hoping Gwendolyn Christie does.
I would love to see it, but somehow I don't think it's likely.
No one's brave enough.
Also, I don't know if Andrew and Anna would like the amount of attention that that one look would obviously get.
Or would they? It's like, ooh, good, good. Less people are talking about Galliano the man. More people are talking about his work.
His merkin. Exactly.
Those are some stellar outfits we hope will be on the Met Gala red carpet. But Chelsea, let's talk about some outstanding outfits that happened this past week.
We obviously need to discuss the fact that Meg Stalter copied Carrie's much-memed dominatrix look from Sex and the City. I believe she wore it on Watch What Happens Live, or on the way to Watch What Happens Live.
Well, her and Paul Downs seem to be on some sort of guerrilla marketing for the Emmys campaign, because did you see that they recreated the Carolyn Bessette JFK Jr. park fight, called a paparazzi, I assume called a paparazzi, and submitted the photos to Dumois?
It's strange timing because Hacks is over, but it's not close enough to the final awards season for Hacks either.
I mean, the Emmys are coming up and they're all nominated. I wonder if Emmys voting is closing soon, or it could just be that Paul Downs is in New York and Meg Stalter was like, let's just do some bits.
These are people that are down to clown, clearly.
But the Carrie reference is so specific. They recreated the scene where she shows up at Big's place with the whip in her mouth and goes, well, laugh, it's a joke.
The writing crop.
Yes.
Specifically. It is funny and very self-aware because Meg Stalter has been doing these very stunty, conceptual red carpet looks. And Carrie also does that, right? She's dressed like a dominatrix. She's dressed like a French woman delivering Le Big Mac. You know, she also loves to clown and dress up and do a bit.
So you're saying Meg is a Carrie?
Absolutely a Carrie.
Yeah, I think a couple months ago she showed up on Seth Meyers acting as if she was the one who stole Madonna's Coachella clothing, which, have they still not found that clothing?
I don't think they found it. I think we would know if they had.
There's just some gay in a bunker who will never come out now because he knows the Madonna fans will kill him.
We will recognize that Confessions outfit.
We know that mid-2000s era post-Tom Ford Gucci.
Okay. I also want to discuss Gabriette's wedding looks.
Yes. This happened a few weeks ago, but there were just these incredible photos from their wedding that was released that makes me want to get married again. I continue to not get Maddie Healy, but she looks incredible, and they do look like they fuck.
Totally. They look like they fuck. This is like one of the best celebrity bridal looks I've seen in a long time. And I feel like celebrity bridal looks are getting like increasingly crazy and increasingly showy. And this one was just, it was just perfect. It was designed by Fecal Matter.
They're fecal mattering everywhere.
They really are killing it. We make fun of the name, but they have created some of the most important looks of the year when I think about it.
And they designed three looks for Gabriette, which was featured in a Vogue video where she did her last fitting in Paris. And her wedding dress, I didn't immediately clock the reference, but as soon as she said she was inspired by Winona Ryder's costuming in Dracula, I'm like, oh, that's what that is.
Totally. The wedding dress had a dropped waist and this incredible kind of ruching over the hips. The silhouette was very akin to a gown that Winona Ryder wears in that movie. And the sleeve also. It looked like very Victorian Belle Epoque vibes, but like more aligned with something that like Vivian Westwood would do or something.
Spooky.
Spooky, deconstructed. Really amazing. But I actually thought that her after party look was even cooler, which was like this insane, ruffly sort of tailcoat that she wore with these like cropped little flares and like a little top hat. Very Galliano.
I was also thinking of Carrie when Berger makes fun of her for her tiny hat.
Yeah. But she just really went for it. Good for her.
Well, also good for her for getting that Jimmy Choo check for a wedding themed collection campaign that she starred in. And then instead of wearing Jimmy Choo for her wedding shoes, she wore these insane curved Christian Louboutin, but fecal matterified Christian Louboutin heels.
It's really impressive that they have created an instantly recognizable shoe in such a short amount of time. Good for them. And speaking of which, we should also talk about the fecal matter Zendaya look from the Odyssey press tour.
Yes, I believe it was at the New York premiere. She dressed as an angel.
Gorgeous. Classically gorgeous. In the show, it read as more gothic just because of the casting and the overall vibe. But like, because the hair had this sort of pre-Raphaelite sort of look, it ended up looking like classical art more than anything.
She looks very ethereal. Obviously, they're referencing the Athena statue as she plays Athena in the Odyssey. Or as we noted last week, woman that just looks disapprovingly at Matt Damon for 3 hours.
Totally.
Oh my God. Poor La Roach. I hope he gets a vacation after this. And Zendaya as well. Because she went back to back. I mean, her and Tom Holland had back to back press tours of the Odyssey. And then once that stopped, it was the new Spider-Man film.
I think they're the only ones that are like actually working.
Yeah.
I just feel like there's not that much going on right now.
Well,
aside from Spider-Man and the Odyssey.
Well, yes. I mean, I would say her, Tom Holland, and Robert Pattinson are basically the only people making movies right now.
Yeah.
Other than, of course, the Sex Purge film, which, guys, I think we need to see it.
Still don't know what it's called.
One Night Only.
Okay. I do want to give La Roach a shout out also for this one look that he orchestrated for Zendaya to wear during the Spider-Man press tour, which is a recreation of a dress that Willie Smith designed for a Spider-Man comic, essentially, or like a paper doll.
Yes, I believe it was in 1987, Willie Smith designed various looks for a paper doll, Mary Jane, which is the character that Zendaya plays, and they recreated one of those dresses.
Yeah, he got Laquan Smith to do his sort of take. It wasn't an exact replica.
No, which people were mad about.
But I appreciate the level of niche of this reference is incredible.
I believe this is the fourth Spider-Man film that both Zendaya and Tom Holland have been in. So it's like, you gotta get pretty niche at this point on the red carpet if you're doing themed red carpets. Eating well can be difficult when life gets busy, and I've tried all the hacks to save time while still eating well. I've done meal prepping, ingredient prepping, meal kits, and ordered far more takeout than I care to admit. And then I found Forkful. They are chef-cooked, fresh, never frozen, ready-to-eat meals made with high-quality premium proteins. Think grass-fed bison, wild-caught salmon, and fresh vegetables. And best yet, zero seed oils. With everything I tried before, there was always a catch. I got tired of eating the same thing with meal prepping, meal services often use industrial seed oils that can be harmful to your body, meal kits promise convenience but require prep and cleanup. And now with a child, I really don't have time for any of it. I just want a fully cooked, delicious, but healthy meal that is ready in under 3 minutes that also involves no cleanup, and I got that with Forkful. I ordered some of their meals and I was very impressed by their selection, which has options for gluten-free, dairy-free, keto, plant-based, GLP-1, and low-carb meals. Personally, I selected high-protein meals. It arrived to my door within 48 hours of ordering, and before I could even taste my first Forkful meal, Paul had made himself one, the penne vodka with chicken, which I was very jealous about because that was the meal I was most excited to try. But then I had the pulled pork carnitas over Mexican cauliflower rice. I knew of cauliflower rice as a concept, but I had never had it before. Delicious. I am now obsessed. Having a variety of ready-to-go meals that involve no cleanup has given me my evenings back. So thank you, Forkful. Explore their plans and menu of fresh, ready-to-eat meals at ForkfulMeals.com and use code ALFIT to get 50% off your first order. That's ForkfulMeals.com/ALFIT and use promo code ALFIT for 50% off. Thanks to Forkful for sponsoring this episode.
Also, can we talk about Billie Eilish? Because this week we saw the first photos of her with her Sylvia Plath transformation for this upcoming Bell Jar movie that Sarah Pauly is directing.
And if you remember Fuckettes, we were a bit apoplectic at the news that Billie Eilish would play the on-screen version of Sylvia Plath. The character has a different name, but it's
Esther Greenwood.
Esther Greenwood, but it is basically Sylvia Plath. So you would imagine that a character would look like the author. And guess what? We're eating our words. She does. She looks great.
She really does. The glam is really, really impressive because Billie Eilish is someone that naturally has Instagram face. Like, I don't think she's achieved this through fillers, you know, like a lot of other girls, but she just like has that look. Like she's staring into an iPhone.
Yes, her face has the proportions of someone who spent a lot of money at a med spa to get, but she just naturally has it.
But they completely offset her features by using lipstick in a way to really sort of minimize the scale of her lips and also just removing like her eyebrows basically, or making her eyebrows so much lighter to the point that it like completely changes the look of her entire face.
They've also changed her hair, which we typically have seen as black, or there was that blonde bombshell era, and it is instead this auburn reddish hue, which also has a very transformative effect.
Yeah.
Like, you initially sent me the photo, and I did not clock immediately that it was Billie Eilish.
So, good for them. Okay, I want to discuss one more fashion thing, which is the newly announced collaboration between Denim Tears and the estate of Andre Leontelli. This is the first collab that anyone has done with his estate. And they released a lookbook this week, which featured pieces from the collaboration mixed in with other new Denim Tears pieces. We don't have clear photographs of every piece in this collection, but you can definitely get a general sense of the line. And I thought it was really fucking cool. I think that Tremaine approached this from a really interesting angle, which is leaning more into the showiness of Andre and the sort of eclecticism of his more casual looks, his street style looks, rather than the sort of more upscale chic stuff.
It's an approachable Andre Leontelli.
They made fake fur trapper hats. There is a graphic tee with a photo of Andre and Lee Radswell, which is incredible. It was like a giant photo print of this one paparazzi photo of them on the Upper East Side.
Yeah, is it the Upper East Side? I'm looking at it now. Or is it in Bryant Park, kind of in between fashion shows? Either way, you need it.
I need it. And this piece is a three-way collab between Denim Tears Billionaire Boys Club and the estate of Andre Leontelli, because in the paparazzi photo that they use, he is wearing this Billionaire Boys Club like knit zip-up that has like this giant dollar sign on the back of it. And they also recreated that with Billionaire Boys Club for this collaboration, which I thought was fun and such a insane detail.
So I'm seeing that this collection is going to release across 5 separate drops throughout the season, with drop 1 launching on Friday, August 14th, 11 a.m. Eastern. Set your clock, Chell.
Yeah, I don't know how much of this is actually for me. I appreciate it, but I think I may be stepping away with the t-shirt. I don't know if I'm the person that should be wearing the tee with the rhinestone NAACP logo, which I feel is another highlight of this collection.
Fair, fair. But who knows where that shirt is dropping? Is it in the first drop? Is it in the fifth drop?
We'll see, but I thought this was cool. Okay, what else?
Well, you're indulging me this week by allowing me to take a few minutes of the podcast to tell you about some influencer drama in a segment we're calling Lauren's Influencer News Corner.
Great. Bring it on. I don't care about any of these bitches, but I will listen.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So Nara Smith was recently on Call Her Daddy, and the big highlight of this interview was this moment where she distances herself from the trad wife movement. Before I get into this, I just want to note, I do not understand the rhyme or reason of how Call Her Daddy books guests, because sometimes it is around a press tour, like Olivia Wilde went on Call Her Daddy when the invite was coming out, but sometimes there are just people on there who have nothing to promote.
Well, she does have a cookbook coming out, right? I don't know much about her, but I know that much.
Oh, I guess so.
She has a cookbook coming out, and she's also, right, coming off of the reveal of her child's cancer diagnosis.
Yes. So you do know a little about Nara Smith.
That's about as much as I know that in the monotone voice. I have seen her content, and I do appreciate it, honestly, how extreme it is and how funny it is.
Right. So that's kind of at the center of what has gone the most viral from this interview, which is Nara Smith discusses to Alex Cooper her confusion of being made the poster child for the tradwife movement, which a lot of people are mad because they feel she's being hypocritical, and they're right and they're wrong.
Well, she's too cunty to be a tradwife in the traditional sense. I mean that in terms of like how fabulous she looks.
Well, also by virtue of the fact that she's even making content and making money from that content and therefore contributing financially to the household.
Right.
By virtue of all of that, she's not a tradwife. However, she did tread into those visuals and that language. So she can't be shocked that she was made the poster child of this movement, because she definitely was using a lot of dog whistles to attract that audience, male and otherwise. But also, anyone that genuinely thought she was a trad wife is kind of an idiot, because by virtue of her doing this and being a content creator, she's not.
In addition to her being too fab to be a trad wife, she's also too weird to be a trad wife. Like, she's a fucking weirdo. I mean that as a compliment.
She is a weirdo, but also she's married to Lucky Blue Smith, who grew up in the Mormon religion. Many people believe that they are Trump supporters. So there you go. But she lives in Connecticut, and she now seldom makes videos because people commented and were mean to her, and her daughter has cancer now.
Well, that's awful.
But will we buy the cookbook?
The cover of the cookbook is incredible.
I wonder what recipes are in this cookbook, because part of the thing, and we've talked about Nara Smith before, is there's a bit of performance art. And when you say that she's very funny, I think what you're referring to are things like, "My children wanted pigs in a blanket, so I made pigs in the blanket from scratch." Like, a lot of the food she's making for her children would take 6 hours. She's not actually making them that for lunch. It's a bit. But are those recipes in this cookbook?
I don't know.
Clearly, I didn't do enough research for this influencer corner.
I do feel like with the cover, though, she is aping like Layla Gohar a bit, and her sort of absurd look, I guess, or the absurdity that she's sort of brought to food styling and things of that nature. But I'd be curious to see what the inside of the book looks like.
Is the inside as aesthetic as the outside? Okay, moving on. The Cut recently wrote an article about how Nantucket is revolting against influencers. Sort of. So there's a woman named Sylvia whose grandfather started a store in Nantucket called Sylvia's Antiques that has been open since 1927. And Sylvia recently posted a sign in her store, a wooden sign in the antique shop that said "no influencers." This image went viral. It appeared on Reddit. It appeared in other pieces of social media. And a lot of people felt that this was in reference to a woman named Paige Lorenz, who is an influencer and has her own brand called Dairy Boy.
What's Paige Lorenz's like worldview or aesthetic, or what's her vibe?
Just being, you
like
know.
In a Gwyneth Paltrow mold or in a Kim Kardashian mold, or, you know,
in a sort of a hybrid. I mean, I would say she's more in the Hailey Bieber mold.
Okay.
Kind of a clean.
Aloe?
Definitely aloe. A very clean girl aesthetic who fetishizes a East Coast sensibility, let's say.
Okay.
She has a brand named Dairy Boy that sells apparel. And it's very much that, like, I'm wearing...
Wait, apparel?
Oh, yeah.
And not, like, ice cream sandwiches and popsicles?
No, it's Dairy Boy and it's apparel. That's why I was a little stilted when you were like, what's her vibe? Because there is this kind of collapsing of influencer aesthetics where it's like... She's Hailey Bieber-ish, and there's a clean girl, aloe, matcha vibe, but then also it's a lot of shilling nightgowns to go grocery shopping with.
Right, so it's a little more like cottagecore?
Cottagecore, but we're still doing Pilates and we're still, you know, jacked.
Okay, to each their own.
Anyway, she started her first retail location of Dairy Boy in, guess where, Chell? Nantucket. So people, including Paige Lorenz, who through this article I learned I've been confusing Paige Lorenz and Taylor Lorenz as the same person. It also gets confusing because Paige Lorenz gives a quote in this article.
Or Taylor Lorenz.
Oh, sorry. I'm getting them confused. Yes, Taylor Lorenz gives a quote in this Paige Lorenz article.
Okay.
Anyway, people including Paige Lorenz thought that that no influencer sign was a dig at her because there had been lines down the block to get into her store, Dairy Boy, which, as you've noted, does not sell dairy products.
Oh, did I tell you that I encountered a Cher Lotto truck in the wild?
Yes, Cher's gelato brand that we've never tasted and we don't believe exists.
It was parked outside the Abbey.
Of course.
Of course. Where else would the Cher Lotto truck be? I have to say, I was disappointed with the quality of the gelato. There was a separation between the sort of chocolate and the creamy, like, which as I understand is like a big no-no. When it comes to gelato, like it shouldn't feel gritty, like sand, like chocolate sand.
No, 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 no.
So I came, I saw, I ate, not super impressed, but Cher has her other virtues, clearly.
Okay, so Paige Lorenz wrote on Sylvia's post. Again, remember, Sylvia is the woman who posted the no influencer sign. Paige Lorenz wrote, "If you call yourself a feminist but proudly put up a no influencer sign, it's worth asking who you are attempting to delegitimize and why."
Oh, God. Okay, yeah, play the woman card. Why don't you? As if there aren't, like, horrible male influencers everywhere also, especially, like, gay male influencers, like, ravaging antique stores for stuff to put in their, like, apartments with 20,000 lamps.
And there has been an over-tourism problem in Nantucket, as it is a small island, for a long time. It predates social media, but social media has made it so much worse. And now adding the lineification of a pop-up store is not what this town needed.
Right. I personally can't imagine taking a sign that personally.
Yes, and it's also having the opposite effect because I saw that sign on social media. So now people are going into Sylvia's Antiques not to buy antiques, but just to take a photo of the old-timey no influencer sign.
So Streisand effect.
Yeah. Perfectly put, Chelsea. Now, the last news article I'm going to discuss is the third most story on Vulture right now, which is an article called The Influencer Recession, which is less about the cost of living crisis hitting the influencer set and more about how influencers can't post cute photos of their outfits anymore, and so they pivoted to posting rage bait. The main focus of this article is a woman named Audrey Peters, whose content the last few years, which I have seen, has been like, what Hermes bag was I offered in Paris? And like, what Chanel shoes should I wear to dinner? But as she phrases it in the article, you can't just be showing matcha Pilates aloe anymore. So now she posts this rage bait videos where she orders every single meal out. So it starts with like, it's 11:20 in the morning and I ordered Starbucks. And because she had it delivered and all the delivery fees, something that would have been, I don't know, $17 is $35.
Right.
And so it's her showing hundreds and hundreds of dollars of takeout that she spends, you imagine, every day. And this got a lot of engagement. And then it got people to make videos about her videos.
So she's a genius.
Yes. She does this because this gets great engagement, so now it's become a mini-series that she does. Because really what the influencer recession is that brands are having increasingly stricter metrics for engagement. So these influencers have to juice their engagement to be able to retain the brand deals.
Right.
The article is basically about overall where we are in the attention economy and how, as they phrase it, an unposed photo with butter yellow type, as they call it, does better than a fully edited video. But the article's kind of confusing because at the same time, in different parts of the article, they discuss the fact that people don't want to see other people in cute outfits or posting about getting another Chanel bag. They want to learn something from the content they're seeing.
Right.
But it shouldn't be too produced.
Well, I've heard that's the content with the highest engagement is content that is entertaining and also educational, which wasn't always the case.
Yeah.
And I get it. The same formula that worked a decade ago on Instagram does not work now. It is a video platform. It is not an image platform.
Yeah, and that is partially how Instagram wants it. But the article ends with, in an age of the endless scroll, people want to feel like the hours spent on their phones are not in fact a waste of time, rather a means of gaining access to smart and cool people who lead interesting lives off camera.
I would love if my algorithm would prioritize that more. I feel like my algorithm still sucks, especially on Instagram.
Yeah. And also, Instagram went waywards for me when we lost the chronological post.
And that was like a decade ago at this point. Look, it's completely different. It's a news aggregator. It's not about sharing photos of your outfit or your meal or whatever, like it used to be.
Yeah. And Taylor Lorenz offers a quote for this article as well, where she discusses how we're starting to see how AI is going to affect social media, specifically influencers, where you used to be able to influence of like, these are the products I shop, here's, you know, my skincare routine, and effectively ChatGPT, Claude, whatever language model you use, if you use them, can generate that information already. So then it's like, well, then now what do?
I don't know. I'm still interested in what products people use.
For sure. I did send you a portion of the article where Audrey Peters starts discussing her least favorite thing, which is linking in Instagram stories.
Mm.
And then she talks about her strategy for doing that, which is like a DM or like a cutoff page, like a cutoff screenshot of a product that cuts off the price. That's all ways that she juices engagement.
Right. So people click to see the price. I see influencers doing this all the time. I don't follow very many of them, but I've definitely noticed that.
It's just interesting to think that there is a strategy behind those things. But of course there is. And she was doing it because a brand that was considering her for some SponCon wanted to see her metrics.
Right.
This is partially social media platforms' fault. Most specifically Instagram, as we have had to do this as well. The fact that Instagram has existed for 15 years, they've shifted to more of a business platform 10 years ago. To Audrey Peters' point of why she was doing this, just to take you behind the curtain slightly, we literally have to screenshot our analytics. You can't make a nice deck anymore because you could fake your analytics. So we often have to send screen caps, as I'm sure other influencers do, so you can prove like, actually, we're not lying. This is our engagement. But Instagram makes it so hard and it's so unaesthetic.
Yeah.
So I'm often sending 17 different screenshots. That information, which they know that people at a certain level need for brand deals, it's not all on the same page.
Totally. They've also made it so now analytics only go back 3 months, I think.
Right. Anyway, if anyone listening to this podcast works for Instagram, just a suggestion.
You should be able to just have an auto-generated report emailed to you or something.
Yeah, that's it for me in Influencer Corner. Maybe a segment we'll never do again.
I liked it. I like being abreast of these things without actually having to read anything.
And likewise, I talked about what's going on in the influencer world. You're going to tell me a little bit about what's going on in the rebranding world.
Okay, first of all, Us Weekly is no longer weekly.
Excuse me now?
I can't find out anything about this online, but I saw someone post like the editor's letter from the current issue of Us Weekly, and it said, beginning with this issue, Us Weekly transitions to Us Magazine and moves to an every other week publication schedule. You'll also notice something new on our cover. We're retiring weekly from our logo. The Us you love isn't going anywhere. We're simply making official what has already been true for years. As the way we deliver entertainment has evolved beyond a weekly cadence, our name is evolving to reflecting a brand that now connects with you every day in real time.
Are they soft launching that eventually they won't be a printed publication anymore?
Well, it's funny because I've noticed a change in Us Weekly. It is now releasing covers like People Magazine, where it is a shoot with a celebrity. Kyle MacLachlan actually had one pretty recently.
Well, we should note that what we know as millennials of a certain age know as Us Weekly did already start out as Us Magazine.
Yeah, it started as Us. That's what it used to be. Celebrity News, it was more like Entertainment Weekly / Movie Line, if you remember that magazine.
Yeah, Premier Magazine, Movie Line, Entertainment Weekly. Yes, it was more about splashy celebrity coverage. And then somewhere, I think it was Janice Min when she took over the magazine, made it a weekly tabloid. It was trashier than People, but more elevated than Star and the National Enquirer, which was a genius move.
Completely genius. I forget when they made that switch. It would have been the early 2000s, I would think, because it really did coincide with the whole Britney, Lindsay era of celebrity.
In 2000, it converted into a full weekly publication format. So yeah, 25 plus years.
RIP to the greatest magazine ever.
Well, it feels like in that statement you read, the subtext is like, the news we print weekly is old already, so just go to our website.
Yeah, totally. And that wasn't always the case. You used to have to read Us Weekly to see the most important paparazzi photos.
Honestly, the magazines that I'm buying on eBay are quite literally old Us Weekly magazines from my youth.
Yeah.
Specifically, the ones about the Winona Ryder trial.
I know someone who is a librarian, not Nikki, that was trying to track down, see if anyone had a full set of Us Weekly. No one does. It like doesn't exist. That's one of those magazines that like will get lost to the sands of time because no one was really diligent about archiving it or seeing how influential it was. I mean, I'm sure Us Magazine has everything at their headquarters, but
I don't know. Now I'm just looking at an Us Magazine lot. What do we got? Ooh. Yeah, you're right. It's usually you can get a bunch of these magazines from people who are obsessed with one particular person, like a celebrity, like Madonna or Celine Dion.
Right, but to get a full set would be like, I mean, it's possible, certainly, but it would take someone years.
Ooh. Sorry, move on. I'm just looking at this lot of Us Weekly magazines from 2002, 2003, 2004, all around Britney Spears, including this cover, I assume from 2002, that says Sex Tell All, Britney versus the Beast. And the Beast in question is Fred Durst.
Wow. Okay, moving on. I want to talk about these new Gap fragrances. Gap has re-released a bunch of fragrances that they first manufactured back in the 90s, scents like Heaven, Grass, Lauren, I'm sure that you remember these.
Of course I do.
They were in these very sort of distinctive frosted bottles with little illustrations that pertained to the theme of the fragrance. They had these brushed aluminum caps. It was very 90s, very fabulous. For some reason, they have chosen to reissue these fragrances, but they have completely changed the bottle and they have also reformulated the fragrance. What the fuck? Who is this for?
You put in a link to the Allure article. I assume you read it. They did get the original people who created the scents back to reformulate the scents. Does that do anything for you?
It does a little for me, but like, why? Like, either just reissue them, or if you want to make more contemporary perfumes that appeal to a mass audience, that appeal to a young audience, then just make new perfumes.
Here's what I find bizarre about the rebrand. And for those who have not seen the original bottles, if you're familiar with the Global Cafe aesthetic, it very much mirrors that. A very niche design philosophy from the early 90s, mid 90s. Here's what I don't understand, which is like the fact that people even know about that aesthetic. And the fact that a late 90s, early 2000s graphic design style has become popular again, I don't understand why you just wouldn't do that.
Yeah, it's deeply weird. Like, I would think that the move would be to, like, reissue them in their 90s packaging.
Yeah.
Make it a limited edition thing just around the holidays. So you and me and everyone our age can just buy them for each other for Christmas/Hanukkah. And then if you want to move into fragrances for real and make something that caters to like a gourmand obsessed Gen Z, Gen Alpha audience, then you can then do that.
Come again? Is this because Gen Z and Gen Alpha love the bear?
Wait, I do not understand that reference. But no, I mean like the scents that are like vanillas and caramels. Like,
got it. Okay. Sweet smells, not like pizza.
Yes. Thierry Mugler actually invented this category of perfume with Angel, which I know you hate.
Yeah, sorry to my mom who would wear Angel when I was a child.
But this is like all younger people want to wear. Not all younger people, and certainly not our more discerning listeners, but like it is a hugely popular type of fragrance right now.
Yeah, I also personally am just so tired of Tulumified products, hotel design. Like, give me the retrofuturism of the late 90s, early 2000s.
I wish. Yeah, the bottle is very simple and soulless. It almost looks like it should be a nail polish and not a fragrance.
You're right. It does look like a nail polish bottle.
It looks like one of those nail polish companies, like millennial nail polish companies that exists now. I just can't put my finger on it.
Did you see the ad campaign with Victoria Peretti? I think that's her name. She was in You.
Right.
It is her, a close-up of her face, and she's acting out on her face what each scent evokes.
Right.
Which feels very Gap in the 90s, but...
It's weird because Gap just achieved that Gap in the 90s vibe with that Hailey Bieber jean and with the marketing for that jean.
Which, to go pivot a little bit into influencer corner for a second, all I got were videos of women who were like, these jeans don't make me look like Hailey Bieber.
Well, no shit, Sherlock. It's a pair of jeans from the Gap at the end of the day.
It's an oversized pair of jeans. Going back to Demna, what is the sizing he's trying to do? Petite but strong?
Oh, it's like tall and strong and
yeah,
petite and they wouldn't say thin, but...
No, I'm like small and strong.
Okay. On a related note, another horrible rebrand happened recently that really no one is talking about, which is L'Occitane. It is the 50th anniversary of this brand.
So they decided to ruin it?
They literally decided to change their packaging so that everything they make looks like a dupe of L'Occitane. And I found this out by going into the store and experiencing it all firsthand.
It's so funny you say that because I literally bought a hand cream at Whole Foods called La Maison de Provence because it looked like a dupe of 90s L'Occitane.
Yeah.
Which is like very kind of shabby chic, cottage core. Like that's...
It's not shabby chic. It's more like classical French packaging, pharmacy packaging even.
Yes. And
heritage, but not super high end.
But this is what is puzzling to me about both of these rebrands, which is... Culture has caught up to the aesthetic that these brands have been doing for years. So just keep doing that.
The fact that they decided to not keep doing that is actually the craziest thing. It blows my mind. Like, I'm actually speechless. Not only did they redesign the packaging, they also changed the name of the almond shower oil. It's like a different product now. And I'm like, babe, that's your flagship product.
I mean, that and your hand cream. If they change the scent of that hand cream, I'm out.
At least the hand cream still has the little circular graphic on it. It didn't get the full Target makeover the way that the shower oil did.
Yes, for those who haven't seen it, most L'Occitane products have physical paper label and they've just removed that.
Yeah, it's now the type is printed directly on the bottle, which can look good. Can look upscale. I feel like Necessaire is an example of a company that does a good job of that without it looking cheap. But this is not that.
You know what it looks like? It looks like the miniatures you would get in a hotel.
Yeah, totally.
Where it's like, this is going in a hotel. We're not going to pay the money to have like paper labels.
All the things. Yeah, they also got rid of the embossing on the bottle. So the bottle just looks like cheaper, more generic, like it was something that was white labeled and not like a custom thing.
Did they get bought by private equity recently? Because that would explain these choices.
I don't know. It's not even that the new type offends me that much. I think it's just like the combination of all of these factors, the renaming, the sort of cheapness that comes with removing labels and embossing. The cap looks cheaper. But did I still buy my almond shower oil? Yes. I don't remember what it's called now, but I did.
So in 2024, Blackstone and Goldman Sachs complete investment to support the privatization of L'Occitane, meaning it was a publicly traded company that they brought private. So I do believe that these choices are kind of based on, I'm going to assume, corporate restructuring.
It's crazy, though, because if you need to move more products, like, that is a marketing thing, not a packaging design thing. The packaging design was always good.
Yes, but I'm sure they are looking to cut some corners and they felt that no one would have noticed, but they don't know that you exist. I don't mean that in an insulting way, but it's just sort of like, guess who noticed? Chelsea Fairless.
Literally everyone would notice. It is the most noticeable jump. And like, I don't know. I get the sense that this company attracts a lot of older customers. Like, they don't want millennial branding on their products, you know? Like, they don't care about that shit.
The real test is, are the stores going to be redone to look like med spas? Then we will know that this wasn't just a cost-saving measure, that this was a whole branding change.
I don't know. The store at the Century City Mall looks the same for now, but...
Well, speaking of a brand that got an overhaul, Coke looks completely different now?
I guess, but I haven't seen it out in the wild. Have you?
We should say the typography for Coke, they have not reformulated, as far as we know, our beloved fridge cigarette.
No. They have redesigned the packaging, and this was a global redesign. Coke looks very different depending on what country you're in. Now it will all look the same, which makes sense. I don't understand why it was like that to begin with. But they are getting a lot of flack online for this redesign, which I don't totally agree with. To me, they did a good job.
Well, there's a New York Times article about this where people have noted that this rebrand, specifically the typography of Coke, looks very similar to Marlboro.
Right, but like, I don't really get that because it's like they didn't really change like the script Coca-Cola logo. The Marlboro typeface is the secondary typeface, not the primary typeface.
Correct.
So I don't see what the big deal is. Also, it reminds you of Marlboro, the cuntest looking pack of cigarettes that exists.
Well, as the New York Times article notes, and I just said, I mean, the joke now is people referring to Diet Coke as a fridge cigarette.
I see the vision and I support it.
Well, eagle-eyed typographers have noted that actually the Coke rebrand very different than the Marlboro typeface. And as someone that lives in a household with a man who does not only graphic design, but specifically makes custom typefaces... This is all I heard about in my household this week.
So he thinks they're like radically different and that people that think they're the same are like crazy?
Yes, I was reading him this quote from James Edmondson, who owns Ono Type in San Jose, California, which when I said that, Paul goes, oh, I know him. James Edmondson says, observers are drawing comparisons from brand memory, but not from font accuracy. While the better width type shares some similarities, Marlboro's Neo Contact is far more condensed or compressed horizontally, he said. Additionally, the serifs of the current Marlboro logo type, quote, features devastatingly handsome slab serifs, substantial terminal smacked on with no curved transition or bracket. Coke serifs, on the other hand, are brackets. Every corner is slightly rounded. And Paul was just nodding his head. He goes, yep, yep, that's all true.
Okay, but to be fair, I think what people are comparing it to is less the typeface that's on an actual pack of cigarettes and more the typefaces that they used in their advertising when you could still advertise for cigarettes.
And also the colors. That red and white put together, if you are a person of a certain age, you're right, reminds you of the Marlboro billboards or ads you would see in magazines.
Totally. And the whole, like, those kinds of typefaces and all the Coke branding, of course, it just reminds you of, like, America. Because to me, that's what America is. It's Marlboro and Coca-Cola is, like, the most, like, design-wise. These are kind of our most iconic things.
Two things that are slowly killing us. What's more American than that?
I know.
Okay, I have to say, I was a Coke Zero girl for years and years. I have now moved on to Dr. Pepper Zero Sugar, but...
Yeah, that can looks like shit, I have to say.
It's, you know, if anyone could use a rebrand, it's Dr. Pepper, honestly.
I'm over here with my mini Diet Coke can, which was noticeably absent from this rebrand. I guess they're not fucking with Diet Coke.
I mean this in a complimentary way, but you DC heads are psychos.
Yeah, true. And I imagine that any rebrand of Diet Coke would be met with nothing but hatred and psychosis.
Yeah, all of you buying Diet Coke just to pour it out on the street.
Wait, what?
Isn't that when there was the big Dylan Mulvaney Bud Light controversy, the whole gag was that conservatives were buying Bud Light to just film themselves pouring it out?
Oh, right. Okay, yes. I understand the reference. That was one of our stupider moments in culture in the last decade.
All right. I think we've said it all.
We've said it all. If you are wondering why we have not touched upon the darkest celebrity news story of our time, which of course is Perez Hilton, we will be releasing a VIP episode that discusses him and some other very dark celebrity news stories next week.
Yes, as we've noted, sometimes there are certain pop culture stories that warrant paywalled thoughts, and these are those. So we'll be releasing that episode early next week.
Until then, bye guys.
Bye.